This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
I'm trying to spread the word about this immense issue, but I find it absurd why so many people are confused. Some people don't understand the weight of this problem. Act now before it gets out of hand, cause Earth is calling. I was 10 years old, exposed to it. The inconvenient truth really made me concerned how it was going to affect the youth. The temp is still rising from the pollution we produce. We need to start striving for a solution to reduce. When we burn fossil fuels like coal and gasoline, we're using dirty energies when we should be using clean. When we burn, we're adding to the greenhouse effect. CO2, CH4, and N2O collect in our atmosphere. They remain up there for years and years, absorbing sun rays that come near. But we need to persevere, cause this makes our planet's temp rise fast. So why can't we find a way to cut back on our greenhouse gas?
We have waited too long. Act now before the moment's gone. The situation's tough, but stay strong until we see the dawn.
The climate's on my mind. The climate's on my mind.
In the summer of 2015, in the Northern Hemisphere, it's another blistering week in North America and around the world as weather records fall. It's 105 degrees or 40 degrees Celsius outside my studio in British Columbia, Canada. The oceanside city of Portland, Oregon experienced back-to-back days over 100 degrees. A heat wave blasted the east coast of the United States and Canada. It's miserable there in the pollution. Europe is cooler this week after a blazing heat wave followed by freakish storms. This same day, a city of 100,000 people in Iran experienced a combination of heat and humidity equal to 163 degrees Fahrenheit or 74 degrees Celsius. It's barely survivable. This El Niño year could be the record-shattering jump in global heating we've been warning is on the way. Welcome to your hotter world.
In the atmosphere.
In the polar seas.
Oh, why did it get too hot?
This week on Radio EcoShock, we turn the tables. Alex Smith is the guest on Post Carbon Radio, as broadcast on KWMR West Marin County, outside San Francisco, California. We go for the big picture on shocking climate change and the eternal question, can we do anything about it? Let's go to Post Carbon Radio hosts Karen Nyhus and Bing Gong.
Welcome to Post Carbon Radio. I'm Karen Nyhus with my co-host Bing Gong. Today, we're pleased to have back on our show Alex Smith of Radio EcoShock from British Columbia, Canada. Welcome, Alex. Do we have Alex on the line?
Yes.
All right. We are so glad to welcome back Alex Smith of Radio EcoShock, and thank you, listeners, for standing by while I dealt with our technical difficulties. Alex, we were so happy to have you on our show a month or two ago, but we just didn't have enough time to dig as deep as we want to. So we're really happy to have Alex back on. Alex has been covering climate change since 2006, is that right?
That's right.
And has done hundreds of interviews, I don't think that's an exaggeration, with the world's top climate scientists, which are downloadable on his site, which I'll just mention. There are two of them. Is it right? Ecoshock.info and ecoshock.org?
That's correct.
Great. Well, Bing and I are here in the studio, and you are up in British Columbia, right? What's the weather like up there today?
Well, actually, it's cooled off. We just went through a 30-day heat wave, and we can talk about that. But right now, thank goodness, it's cooled off a little bit.
Great. Well, I'm glad that it's cool while we're talking, but we will get into that, as you said. We're very pleased to have you back to give us an update on the climate science, because that's so central to the work you've been doing for a decade now. In my opinion, you cover climate science in a depth that really exceeds that of any other radio journalist or podcaster that I'm aware of. So we're interested to hear what you see as the big news stories and emerging trends, and we'll dive into that shortly. And I want to promise listeners that we'll also talk about solutions, so they should stay tuned for that. But we are going to look at some of the hot and hard new news. So before we do that, delve into the science, since we do have the full hour with you, I wanted to set the stage a little bit. In my observation, it seems the American press has kind of dropped off its coverage of climate science in the last 5 years or so. By contrast, I would say the British press, for example, including especially the UK Guardian, have not. But they take heat for that. Way back as early as 2006, when you were starting to broadcast, they were sort of blamed for putting out what's called climate porn. And there's a lot of debate about how to communicate climate science if your goal is to inspire people to action, which presumably any of us, any non-denier, wants to do. So, Alex, for you, you've covered a lot not only about the science but also about communicating climate science in an effective way. You've talked with a lot of psychologists. You've covered despair. And you did a show recently called How to Avoid Thinking About Climate Change. Can we start with your thoughts on the responsible balance in journalism between telling hard truths and couching it in terms which can either motivate or discourage people? What have you learned in the last decade of trying to communicate difficult climate science to the public?
That's a very difficult problem, Karen. One thing I've learned is that the mass media news have realized that we pay most attention to threats, you know, whether it's baby kidnappings or whatever. If it bleeds, it leads. That's the mass media that we've grown up with. And it's true that programs that I do with solutions tend to get fewer listeners and downloads than very threatening news. So there's something in us that wants to be titillated, and some people have suggested our brains are really like hard drives that collect threatening information so we can survive better the next time it happens. So I was really very pleased to speak with the Norwegian eco-psychologist, and it's fun to think that there is such a thing as an eco-psychologist. His name is Per Espen Stoknes. And he talks about why public concern about climate may be falling, even as the science becomes more certain that it's happening. His book is called What We Think About When We Try Not to Think About Global Warming. And he talks about the 5 D's of denial, and they are distance. So we think that, well, climate change will happen in South America or the Arctic or somewhere far away. It's not really our problem. And the whole problem of doom, where people just feel so terrible about things that they can't hear, they can't bear to hear anymore about it, and they sort of tune out. And he's got another couple of psychological terms. There's dissonance, for example, where what seems like a terrible thing is developing, and yet world goes on as usual. We still get in our car and go to work, so it's hard to get those two different pictures of the world together in one head. And then there is the usual denial, that we find it easier to deny something that we don't want to hear about. And the question of identity is his last factor. And identity, really, you know, you picture who you are within your civilization and within your family and so on. And psychological tests have shown that where information about reality conflicts with identity, that we throw out that information. The information loses. Identity will override the facts in our own brains. So those are all problems we have to overcome. But he does have some solutions. Per Espen Stoknes talks about the power of social networks, and especially studies that showed we're more affected by what our neighbors do than a scientific argument, or even when they tried to pay someone to change their minds, they wouldn't do it. But if their neighbors changed their minds, they would. So you can have a lot of power yourself just by putting up a couple of solar panels, because you don't know how that will multiply out into your neighborhood, where someone says, well, Julia or Jim did it, we should do it too. So that's one of the positive things that we can play with about human psychology to help get us out of this mess.
Thank you. That's great to know. I think that's going to be very encouraging to a lot of our listeners who, you know, try to hang in there with us and listen to this hard stuff. And sometimes we all feel like, gee, is what I'm trying to do making any difference? So thank you. Are there other barriers that you found to effectively communicating climate science to a general audience? And do you, as Radio EcoShock, what do you know about your listeners? Do you think your audience are generalists?
I think that they are. I have a very informed audience. They have quite often university education, but not always. But they're people who are looking around them and interested in other places in the world as well. You know, a majority of people, it seems like, are mostly interested in their hometown, maybe their state, possibly their country, and that's about the end of it. Here in Canada, we used to laugh because the American weather maps would always show this great vacancy above a line at the 48th parallel and 49th parallel and nothing where Canada should be.
Right.
So we don't want to be like that. And I find that my audience is willing to listen to stories about coal in India or great fires in Australia. And I really value that. I think one of the big barriers is that it's also new, even to climate scientists. There are new terms being invented to communicate things we've never seen before. None of this was taught in school, and that's something we need to address. And we all need to go back to school, really. I learn a lot by YouTube videos made by scientists on climate change, and that's a good place to start.
And you're in a great position because I imagine you've done some sort of sorting of the wheat from the chaff, both by interviewing people, and I presume that you read papers now and again to sort of get a sense of what's being published before you ask people on the air. Is that true?
I do indeed. I really try and get the papers from the scientists involved and also look at critical comments, because any paper is peer-reviewed, and some of those peer reviews will bring up problems with the study. So I try and cover all sides of it before we do the interview.
Right. Well, when we talk about climate communications, I noticed you did a show recently with psychologist Margaret Klein-Solomon, who I talked about the transformative power of climate truth. What is there besides devastation in the truth about the climate?
Well, she was quite interesting. You know, she says that psychoanalytical work, and that's the kind she does, helps a patient accept conflict within themselves. And I thought, well, what's that got to do with climate? But you know, in their work, you might love someone, and yet you also sort of hate them. But we have those similar mixed emotions, because in spite of our climate knowledge, this fossil-powered world is all around us, and it's almost inescapable on an individual level. So we feel guilty about our energy use, and yet we know we shouldn't, and yet we want to drive up and see our parents or something. It's that conflict, and psychoanalysis can help us deal with those kinds of conflicts. But her main emphasis as far as the solution is that what happened during World War II in the United States, you know, it was just the early days of 1942, Pearl Harbor had just happened, and the government, by a single mandate, for example, said to General Motors and all the car makers, you won't make another single car. You're going to transform your entire industry into making the tanks and trucks that we need, parts for airplanes and ships, and they did. And you couldn't buy a new car for a couple of years there because they weren't making them. So that's the kind of big change that can happen when a big threat arrives. And this big threat has arrived in the form of climate change. Hillary Clinton has used that example. Many NGO heads like Lester Brown of Earth Policy Institute have used that example. So what Klein-Solomon has done is helped set up an organization which offers a climate pledge, and it allows you to sort of state what your goals are and how much you can put into making this change. So that's at climatemobilization.org. And she also started a Facebook group. It's now run by others, but it's called Climate Change, It's Personal. You can look for that, and that's how people who are feeling this climate crisis don't have to feel alone. They can talk to other people who are thinking it through and what this all really means.
Alex, let's delve into some of the hard stuff. Let's say I've been tuned out of climate science for a few years. What do you think are the top two or three stories I should know about that I wouldn't have known about a few years ago or that have significantly changed or developed in that time?
Well, I think the two big stories are happening at the polls, and that's out of our news focus. You know, we don't have any reporters there. Most people don't have any interest in it because there aren't many people living there, whether it's in the Arctic or Antarctic. And so we have this ability to not pay attention to it, but big things are happening there. In the Arctic, I think more people know about that the sea ice has melted back and continues to melt back more each year. That's changing our weather, even down into California, which we'll talk about in a little while. And the permafrost, the land, I think it's about 20% of the world is actually frozen. We don't know that about our planet, but the ground is frozen right down underneath. That's starting to melt, and when it melts, there was plant life there a long time ago. It got frozen as well, and it gets released as carbon dioxide, or if it's under pools of water, as methane, and that will add more and more climate-changing gases to the atmosphere, perhaps as much as we're adding with all our cars and ships and boats and factories, so that there comes a point where even if humans cut back, the Arctic will be tossing in more greenhouse gases that will continue to warm the world. So that's a big story, and we could also talk about methane at length. There's methane, which is a type of greenhouse gas that's more powerful than carbon dioxide, and it's sort of frozen, buried under the sea, but that's starting to get released as well. And the other pole, Antarctica, we assumed that it was stable or even getting colder, perhaps. But in fact, the glaciers, especially in West Antarctica, are melting at a tremendous rate. Warm seawater is going underneath them. And that is going to raise the sea level much faster than we expected. James Hansen's got a new paper out about that. Maybe we can talk about that in a few minutes.
Yeah, well, it reminds me that Hansen was talking about that possibility definitely 6 or more years ago. He was saying, hey, there's lubrication of the ice sheets and, you know, in the South Pole. And that was very marginal at the time and speculative. It sounds like the science has become more certain.
Definitely. NASA, with their satellites, can measure the mass of ice, and they know that it's disappearing at a tremendous rate. And, of course, it doesn't disappear. It becomes water in the sea. And so we will have rising sea much faster than we thought. Hansen has a new paper that he hasn't quite published yet, and it's unusual for him to talk about a paper before publication, but I guess the news of it has leaked out. And what it shows is that the doubling time of melt rates in places like Greenland, for example, is much shorter than they thought. So if you have so many gigatons of ice melting this year, we thought it might be 100 years before there would be twice as much melting. But now he's saying, well, no, the historic record shows that doubling times can be as short as 5 to 20 years, not 100 or 200 years. And so he's actually predicting we could see sea level rise anywhere between 3 and 20 feet by 2050. Now, that's just astounding stuff. That will affect Los Angeles and all the oceanside communities. It will drown parts of Florida. It will make most of the mega cities around the world uninhabitable that are on the ocean. It's just a huge, huge statement. And this is one of the preeminent scientists from NASA. He's retired now, but Hansen is one of the world's greatest climate scientist. So when he says these sort of things, a lot of people are going to listen.
He's also been critical of the 2% degree centigrade target that the UN is pushing for.
He's called it crazy to call 2 degrees safe, because we're at about not quite at 1 degree change now, and look at what's happening. We've got major changes in the geophysical system of the Earth. If we go to 2 degrees, we won't be able to handle all of the things that will happen. And he's actually trying to get us to dial back our carbon dioxide in the atmosphere somehow, whether it's through geoengineering or biochar or many different ways, carbon farming, but somehow get it back to 350. That's why you have 350.org, as he said. That's the level at which you might hold on to the ice sheets at the poles. And those ice sheets are what keep our climate and our whole plant system and our ocean system the way that we've been used to for a long, long time to survive. It's been at least 100 million years since we've had as much carbon dioxide in the air as we're putting in now.
And just to be clear and to emphasize what you just said, you know, we're all sort of used to hearing about reducing greenhouse gas emissions, and even if we reduce our emissions, they're still accumulating as long as they're being emitted faster than they're being absorbed. But you use the term dial back. You mean we're above 400 and we have to get back below 350, so we need negative carbon emissions, right?
Right, and that's almost hard to imagine because we've built coal plants to last 60 years. Some were just built in the last 10 years. And we've, you know, built up this whole system that depends on carbon. But not only can we not burn what's left, we have to somehow figure out a technology to take the carbon back out of the atmosphere. And if we don't, we're going to have trouble surviving as a species.
This is Radio EcoShock. You are listening to a rebroadcast of an hour-long interview with Radio EcoShock's Alex Smith on Post-Carbon Radio on KWMR Community Radio in California.
So it's about 20 minutes past the hour. This is KWMR, and this is Post-Carbon Radio. I'm your co-host, Karin Nyhus, with Bing Gong, and we are talking with Alex Smith, who is the longtime host of the Radio EcoShock podcast out of Canada. And we're getting an update today on climate science and a few other related issues. As we delve back in, you know, you've covered this for so long and in so much depth. I wonder what, if anything, has surprised you recently. Have you learned anything that you would call surprising?
Oh, I'm surprised every day. I'm kind of shocked. I look through climate news and climate science, and my jaw sort of drops, and I ask myself, what does this really mean? Because it's huge. I mean, just for example, in the last month, there was a paper came out that said that ocean heating, the oceans are getting warmer. They're getting warmer off the coast of California. They're warmer off the coast of New England. They're warmer in many parts of the world. It's irreversible, scientists now say, so that even if we stop using our carbon fuels, the ocean is going to continue to get warmer and warmer. And, of course, that affects our weather and it affects our agriculture and affects all sorts of things. So, to me, I just found that, well, a little disturbing and difficult to process. You know, we think as humans that if we just change our ways, it'll all go back to the way it was. That's a common human wish mechanism, I think. But really, time only moves in one direction, and so does nature. So maybe things could go back the way they were, but it might be a few million years from now, and that doesn't really mean much to us as humans.
What might be the mildest, most hopeful climate perspective you consider credible?
I think the best vision I could see would be an emergency program, as we talked about, to convert our civilization towards green energy, so running off solar power and wind energy, perhaps tidal energy, hydropower we could use. There's various types of renewable energy. Geothermal has a lot of promise, where you take the heat from deep out of the earth and use that to boil water and make electricity. You know, if we can do that, that would be hopeful, but that has to be combined with global climate justice, and so that means we can't just convert California to green technology and hope that people in India and Bangladesh will go on leading what we would call primitive lives. They want to have a refrigerator to keep their food just as we do, and they want many of the benefits that we have, internet and lights at night and all those things. So that's not going to be possible unless we sort of lend our know-how and our money and our will towards helping them develop into a green future, not one powered by coal, but one powered by the same things we want to be powered by. So we need global climate justice along with an emergency program to convert to green energy.
So as we talk about the positive and the hopeful, jumping back a second to what surprised you, what are you personally most concerned about in the latest, the current climate news? What is really top of mind for you?
Well, my latest worry, and we can talk about this more in relation to the UN climate talks, it's that our human ability, we have the ability to lie to ourselves, to fool ourselves about important changes in reality. You know, science, Karn and Bing, was invented partly by Sir Francis Bacon in the 1600s, and he thought about how we could check with reality to see whether what we think is real, because after the Middle Ages, they were arguing about how many angels could dance on pins and things that just aren't real. So it is impossible to overestimate this ability to create alternative schemes in our minds that aren't based in reality. We need science to keep going and saying, well, how do you know that? And can we prove it? And how do we check that? And can we measure it? And where is it happening? We have to have that science. And now, Karen, I think the Internet has just added more power to all that when you consider all those imaginary planets hovering around that may affect us and conspiracy theories and people who believe that geoengineering is already happening in chemtrails and things that are very hard to prove with science, and so you wonder, are they true or not? And the supposed scientists that work with fossil fuel companies try to blame the changes on the sun, and we've gone through all that, and we know very well it's not caused by changes in the sun. It's caused by us.
Last week on Post Carbon Radio, we had a program. We talked about the up-and-coming Paris UN climate talks, COP21. And I remember when we spoke last, you indicated some skepticism about what the outcome might be. And I think many of us who have seen what happened in Copenhagen have been let down and understand that the corporations have basically co-opted the process, it seems like. For those of us who put little faith in that process, where do we turn, do you think?
Well, there's two parts to that, I think, Bing. The first part is that the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change has underestimated all the things that have happened so far, and they are the ones who advise the governments on what steps to take, for example, at Paris this December. And they still have something we already talked about, the idea of a 2-degree safe limit, and it's not safe at all, so that's a real problem. The direction we're heading right now, we're headed towards 8 degrees centigrade warming by 2200, and that could mean extinction for most species, including ourselves. And then the plans that they do have, being to stay within a 2-degree safe limit, it's not safe at all, but they assume that geoengineering will happen and that we'll be able to grab carbon out of the atmosphere. But that technology does not exist now. And even if you could find somebody who could invent something to try and do it on the scale we need, like to remove 10 billion tons of CO2, we don't have any industry on that scale. Even iron ore mining only manages to get about a billion tons a year out of the ground. So we're kind of lying to ourselves again. Now, what can we do about it? Well, as you may know, Pope Francis just hosted a gathering of the most climate-aware city mayors around the world, and the most progressive climate action is happening, I think, at the municipal level, which still has more connection to direct democracy than Congress, which may have been bought off by the Koch brothers and other oil producers. So I do encourage people to think globally and act locally, get involved with City Hall, create the new reality we want and need by things like community gardens and total recycling of products, put shopping pressure on retailers and producers to go green, use the marketplace as a ballot box. I think there's a lot of different layers where we can pull a couple of levers, even if the big powers in Paris fail to come up with something to protect us.
In this week's Radio EcoShock show, host Karen Nyus and Bing Gong interview myself, Alex Smith, for Post Carbon Radio in Marin County, outside San Francisco, California.
Well, we're going to take a station break. This is KWMR, Community Radio for West Marin.
All right. Well, the Disaster Council reminds me that we are going to be talking about El Nino and what that might mean for California and this West Marin community. But before we do that, since we have Alex Smith on the air from Radio EcoShock, you're in Canada. So we don't always, like you said, with our weather maps, there's a big blank up there, but you guys are in the Arctic. What's going on in Canada that we're probably not hearing about that really relates to the climate science you've been studying?
Well, just yesterday, there were helicopters flying around my home looking for new forest fires. We're getting about 50 to 60 new forest fires a day caused by lightning. And it's been so dry in British Columbia that the place is practically burning down. The usual forest fire budget is in around 5 to 6 million, and we're just topping 200 million now in fighting the forest fires this year. We had a 30-day heat wave where temperatures were the kind of things you'd expect to find in Calcutta or Saudi Arabia. It was over 110 degrees around my home here. And that's in the shade, of course.
That's amazing.
So it's crazy. I mean, Vancouver, for example, is the green, wet city. It's so rainy. It's just known for its rain. Well, this spring, they had the driest spring ever on record, and right now they're in what they call a stage 3 water regimen because the reservoirs are running dry, just as they are in California, and any watering of lawns in the city of Vancouver is now banned. You have to let your lawn die and go brown because there isn't enough water to do that. You can still water your vegetable garden, but only with a hose where you have to point the hose at what you're doing. You can't run sprinklers. That's how desperate it is in British Columbia. And then as we go further east in Canada, all across the prairie provinces, they've also had great big fires, gigantic things, some the size of Ireland. Just amazing fires that there's really no stopping. And we go up to Alaska. Again, it's major fire season. I just looked at a map that shows a little red dot everywhere. There's a sizable fire. And the whole state looks like one big red dot. It's unbelievable what's happening there. Their weather has been the sort of thing we would expect in Mississippi. Has been happening in Alaska. Just crazy stuff. But you go further east, it gets colder. And I think that's something that we need to talk about. We need to talk about what's happening with the jet stream, because that is changing our weather, and that is climate-related.
And that's related to El Nino, too. I think everything's interconnected, actually.
Well, El Nino is a tough one for me to understand, and I think for everybody to understand. What we have is over in the eastern Pacific, we have waters that normally are fairly cold and drop down, become hot, and they head over towards South America in particular and change the climate there very much, but also in California. So we're now sort of trying to second-guess what that means for California. Will the flash floods that happened in Southern California just recently be enough to change the drought? Well, experts say no. You need extended rain, possibly for a couple of years, to replenish the water tables that are running dry in California. But, you know, you can get more flash rains with El Nino in California, more mudslides, that kind of thing. So it's kind of a cross between a drought and floods at the same time, if you want to think of it that way. And we don't really know what happened that created a great blob of warm water in the Pacific Ocean off the coast of not just California, but Oregon, Washington State, and British Columbia. A gigantic blob of hot water is out there. And I have yet to find a scientist who can say definitely what caused it, because we've never seen it before. So they've got to get out and study it and take measurements and try and figure out ocean patterns and see what happened there. But it's affecting our weather tremendously on the West Coast.
Yeah, so just to update listeners, if they haven't been following that bit, El Nino does involve a big blob of hot water coming, warm water coming across the Pacific toward the east, and it's happening. And right now it seems like it's on track to be record-setting in magnitude. What we don't seem to know is, as Alex was saying, because there are so many other systems involved, whether that's going to bring us another hot winter like we've been having, or whether we're going to have drowning deluges, and whether it all comes at once, or, you know, it's very hard to know. But I'm already thinking, yeah, how am I going to batten down the hatches just in case? And I know, Bing, you are putting in a drought-resistant lawn, right?
Right. Or ripping up our lawn and, you know, put in gravel paths and drought-resistant plants, and we're putting in a gray water system.
So neighbors, hear that, take note, feel the peer pressure in West Marin County.
Well, it's everywhere. We just moved to a new house, and right now I'm surrounded by a bunch of gravel and sand around the house, and we have to decide what to do about it. Well, if we plant a lawn, that looks like the wrong way to go, the way the climate's going. So we're looking to xeriscaping, as it's called, which doesn't require any care and doesn't really require any water other than what may occasionally fall from the sky. So I've been looking at the wild plants that are around here to see what we can plant. We don't want to bring in invasive species, but it's a real struggle for us. I know in Las Vegas that they paid people to take their lawns out so much a square foot and replace it with xeriscaping.
Yeah, where I live, the city will haul a big truck of wood mulch to your yard if you can show them you have 500 square feet or more of lawn to remove. They'll help you smother it.
That's fabulous. But I'd keep the mulch right away from your house. You know, within a few feet of your house, you don't want wood mulch.
That's true. The fire factor, right?
Well, not just the fire factor, but when you think about what decomposes wood mulch, it's termites.
Mm.
And when they run out of food, then they'll go up the wall and into your house, possibly. So I'm not saying don't use wood mulch. I'm just saying keep it a few feet away from your house.
There we go. There's a right way and a wrong way.
Yeah.
So jumping back to climate science, is there anything else you wanted to say about the jet stream? Because I know that you did I'm pretty sure it was you who did a show with a scientist whose name I don't remember, about the disturbances to the jet stream that we've seen as part of the pattern of climate change.
Yeah, there's a couple of scientists I've talked to about it. One was Paul Beckwith from the University of Ottawa, who's very good at explaining things, and you can look up his videos on YouTube. It's Beckwith, B-E-C-K-W-I-T-H, and you'll learn a lot quickly with him. But the originator of these observations was Jennifer Francis from Rutgers University. And what they noticed was that since the meltback of the ice in the Arctic in 2007, that the weather patterns in North America and indeed around the world have changed. And the jet stream used to be a very fast-moving body of air up high where the jets travel. That's how it got its name. And it used to be if you were heading west, it would take you longer than if you were going east because you get this 1,000-mile-an-hour wind or whatever up high. But the jet stream now no longer moves in a sort of straight east-west pattern. It's slowed down, and it's developed these huge waves. It goes up way over Alaska and then dips down into the center of the United States and up the eastern seaboard. And so the weather you get kind of depends on which side of that jet stream you are. And that's kind of why we had extreme heat and drought in western North America. While they were still having some of their winter coats in eastern North America, it was a late spring and it was kind of cold and wet. And so you can have this diversity on a single continent because of the waves of the jet stream. And it's tending now also to kind of, I wouldn't say freeze in those waves, but those waves tend to get blocked and stay in one position for quite a while. So whatever you're experiencing, you get lots more of it until it finally breaks and changes. And it's thought that these changes in the jet stream also brought the tremendous heat to Russia in 2010 that killed at least 30,000 people, at the same time as it brought floods to Pakistan, which killed thousands more and covered almost a third of the country with water. So these are big changes that can be now explained by science, and it is related to climate change. And the main driving factor, it's a simple idea, and once you get it, you understand a lot about your world, and this is it. The jet stream was caused by the difference between the heat in the tropics and the cold in the Arctic. Now, when that difference becomes less, the Arctic warms up, and that's happening for sure, as we just talked about in Alaska, but all across the pole, it's warming up. Then you have less difference between the tropics and the Arctic, and so there's less to drive this stream of air east to west, and it lets it dip down in these patterns I've just talked about.
You know, that's one of the reasons I wanted to have you on, Alex, because you talk to all these experts, but then you take what they tell you and you translate it into regular human talk, and that's very useful for our listeners. So I'm really pleased that you're here to do that with us. This is KWMR, and we're talking with Alex Smith of Radio EcoShock.
Let's move on to the money behind dirty energy. Last time when we talked, Alex, we were talking with Daphne Wykesham, but I'd like to hear a little bit more because a lot of us who have tracked the science may not feel so confident or informed when it comes to finance. What did you learn from Jeff Rubin on your show when you discussed the carbon bubble? What happens to us when it bursts?
Jeff is a real classic. He was a chief economist for a major Canadian bank, deeply involved in business and especially in energy. But he discovered that the basis of a Canadian economy, and perhaps the American economy as well, is unstable because it's dependent on expensive tar sands oil. And now that the price of conventional oil has crashed below $50 a barrel, the Canadian dollar and the stock market and the economy here have crashed. We're into a recession, even though the government won't admit it. And you've got similar scenes playing out in North Dakota and Texas over fracking. Fracking is very expensive because you have to continually drill new wells, and you got to borrow money to do it. And there have been worries that the fossil fuel energy crash in the United States could be as serious or more damaging than the 2007-2008 housing crash. I mean, big banks and pension funds are heavily invested in fossil fuels. Those were the money makers. But if those loans go bad, and we're talking about trillions of dollars in loans for energy that now is not economical to develop, that could trigger a crash. And that's what Rubin was writing about. But it gets more serious than that, because we know we can't even burn all the reserves that we think we know about. There's no sense these oil companies going out and exploring anymore. And the only reason they do go out and explore is so that they can expand their so-called reserves, and then that lifts their stock price. But they won't be allowed to burn that. I mean, people are waking up all over the world and saying, well, we never had these floods before. We never had this level of fires before. We never, you know, had these things happening. So they're going to want their governments to protect them. And to do that, the only way to do it is to leave the fossil fuels in the ground. And that's what the newspaper, the UK Guardian, has been leading a campaign on. And there have been books written about it. There's whole institutions developed to it. Leave the carbon in the ground. Well, if you do that, then the biggest names on the American stock market, the Canadian stock market, and around the world, these energy companies, we're talking about ExxonMobil and so on, they become worth a lot less than they're claiming they're worth. And so their stocks will be worth a lot less than they're claiming they're worth. And we could have a recession or a depression as that develops. But that may be our best solution, and we could talk about that some more.
Well, we could. I don't know. Bing, do you want to go further with that?
I was going to say that's where I heard the term stranded assets.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Exactly. Mm-hmm. And we've had people on this Radio EcoShock program ranging from scientists like Dr. Kevin Anderson from the United Kingdom to business experts pointing out that the only time that our civilization has really reduced its emissions was, for example, when the Soviet Union crashed in 1990-91. Some of the factories shut down and their civilization shrank a little bit. Then their emissions went down by 5%. Now, happily, the emissions in America have gone down slightly due to more fuel-efficient cars and people being more aware of, the cost of carbon. So there's some hope that if we put in a carbon tax, the kind that James Hansen has called for, a fee and dividend tax, where, yeah, you've got to pay a tax on every gallon of gas or whenever you use carbon, but all the money gathered doesn't go into government, where it could be wasted on something like the military, but goes right back to the people who burn the least carbon. And so you would get a check in the mail every year for your carbon dividend, so you would actually see something for your efforts to reduce carbon. That's the way to go, I think.
It's interesting. I find that an interesting idea in and of itself, and it also flows into and aligns with a much older strategy that both left and right political economists sometimes advocate for, which is called a basic income. And that is the notion that rather than having welfare and social programs, we should guarantee that everyone has a certain amount of income. And it seems to me that could come from a carbon tax if we did it that way.
That would be one of the sources. I think, some countries other than the United States already have a system like that to some degree in place. Mm-hmm. And I don't know. I can't offer an opinion on that.
Yeah, it was a comment.
Well, let's moving on from finance. I'd like to hear about causes for hope. You recently interviewed Dr. Jeremy Leggett on winning the carbon war. What was his message and how did it affect you?
Well, Jeremy Leggett runs one of the larger solar energy companies in Britain. I think he said he did over 200 million pounds, so that'd be, over $300 million worth of business last year selling solar energy in Britain, which is kind of a cloudy place. So he's doing pretty well with that. But before that, he was a scientist and an expert in all kinds of energy. He even, at one point early in his career, advised big oil companies. So, like most of us, Jeremy went through a period of despair as we failed to act. After Copenhagen and up until about 2013, he said he thought we really were doomed. We just weren't going to do anything. But then he started collecting statistics that show that renewable energy is being built much faster than new things like coal plants or even gas generating plants or nuclear plants. When you look at the statistics of where the money is being put to get new energy, it's not into oil, it's into solar and wind and other forms of renewables. So he began to wonder if we may be winning in the business world, even though we don't know about it. I mean, it's just a start, but the trend has changed, and I found that very hopeful.
It seems. Go ahead, Ben.
Yeah. Also, I'm hearing a lot about one of our neighbors has a Tesla electric cars, and they seem to be gaining traction. Although they're very expensive now, I understand they're going to be putting out a more affordable model next year, and with improvements in batteries, that is hopeful too.
You know, Tesla, one of their big announcements that caught my eye is they're going to bring out for about $3,000 a battery pack that you can attach to the wall of your garage, for example, that will collect your solar power and hold quite a bit of power for you in a way that previous using old car batteries or something couldn't do. So that's a major step, and they're building a giant, giant plant in Nevada to produce this kind of battery storage capacity, because that's been one of the problems with renewable energy is how do you store it? Well, Tesla seems to have come up with an answer with it. I think he's sort of the Steve Jobs of the energy world.
Do we know whether that battery is only going to work with Teslas, or can you plug it into your Prius? Do we know?
I think you can use any. You can use it for anything. You could run your house on it.
Oh.
Yeah.
I'd like to, let's see, I noticed you had a recent program with Timothy Mousseau, a professor at University of South Carolina, I believe, who's been doing studies at Chernobyl on the impacts of radiation on bird populations, and he was talking about the Chernobyl forest fires. And I just wanted to put in a plug for an event that we're having here in Point Reyes on Wednesday, September 2nd at the Dance Palace. It's going to be about Fukushima contamination with two top scientists. One of them will be Timothy Mousseau, who's done research at Fukushima and Chernobyl, and Ken Bissler, who is a senior scientist at Woods Hole back in Massachusetts, who's been studying ocean radiation. So I hope folks who are interested in learning about that radiation that's coming at us, it's just now hitting Vancouver, I understand, last month, will attend.
Yeah, those are two great scientists. I think it should be a very good event. I've interviewed Tim Mousseau, and he's been doing research also at Fukushima, and one of the scary things that he found at both sites is that animals don't necessarily drop off dead, but what can happen is their sperm count can drop tremendously, so that you have hardly any functional males, and then, you know, a couple of generations from now, there will be fewer and fewer of those birds and those species. So he's got a lot of great things to say.
Well, I want to put in a plug for Radio EcoShock on coverage of nuclear in Fukushima, because you were really on that and you stayed on it for a long time, and I'm sure you go back to it periodically. Are you still covering Fukushima?
Oh, yeah. I go back and do sort of review shows. You know, the very day that it happened, it was a Friday, I looked at the news and I thought, this is a world-changing event right here. I started doing emergency podcasts on it and did a series of those, and then we interviewed people, top scientists from around the world about it. So it's not over. It's not going to be over in our generation. We'll all grow old and die hearing about radiation from Fukushima. And that's the problem with nuclear power. You got to connect with Helen Caldicott and read her book, Nuclear Power is Not the Answer to Global Warming or Anything Else, to get the whole picture on that.
Do you know whether she's gotten through to George Monbiot yet? Is he still pro-nuke?
I think he is still a pro-nuke, and that just is a sign of climate desperation. People are saying, well, if we're all going to go under as a civilization, we better take anything we can get, and maybe nuclear is the answer. And there have been others. Mark Linus was another green environmentalist, and Stuart Brand, who also said maybe we need nuclear power. But I've looked into this over and over again. I've been studying nuclear power since about 1990, and there are just so many accidents. It's not the right technology for humans. It could be the right technology for somebody, but not for humans.
Yeah. Well, that's a heavy topic, very important and very relevant to climate change because, as you say, people do look to it as a solution out of some form of desperation. But we don't want to end on desperation. So I want to do what Amy Goodman often does on Democracy Now!, which is to ask guests on the way out, what is it, what gives you hope?
My main hope rests with the younger generation. I think older people have shown that we are unable to change our minds and lifestyles. And some of us fall into religious excuses for our denial, but younger people were raised in a more scientific age. They got some science in school, and they tend to question a lot of things. And they've grown up with fast-moving social networks that could communicate the kind of movement we need to avoid the worst form of climate change. So I'm hopeful with all that, and that's partly why I'm dabbling with composing electronic dance music with climate themes. I'm hoping the artistic community can come in and inspire people where maybe science and education haven't done so.
Tickle the other side of our brain, huh?
Yeah.
Well, we're going to have to wrap up in a bit, but I wanted to ask you, Alex, any final words for our listeners?
Well, the reason I called it Radio EcoShock, and incidentally, we are broadcast on 87 nonprofit radio stations in the United States, Canada, UK, and Australia. The reason I called it that is I was thinking of when you're in a car accident, you're in a state of shock. Maybe you've survived the accident, but you're still sitting in the car, somehow unable to move, because you're in a state of shock. And Alvin Toffler talked about future shock, and I think now we have climate shock. It's just so many big changes coming at us so fast. So I think that we can come out of it. We may have to look at it almost in a medical manner to help each other get through this. That's maybe my main message at the end of all of this, is we have to help each other get through this. We can't just take it as individuals and buy our bullets and beans and hide ourselves in the basement. We're going to have to organize new lines of community, and I hope we do.
Well, thank you so much, Alex Smith of Radio EcoShock. Before we go out, do you want to give out links to your listeners for where they can pick up your podcast and learn more about your show?
Yeah, I've got two main avenues there. EcoShock.info is my weekly show blog, and there I summarize some things my guests have said and some links that you can follow up to develop more on each topic. And I think if you just go backwards, browsing through that, you'll pick up quite an education from my really informed guests. And at EcoShock.org, that's my main website, there I've got all of our past programs as free MP3s you can download. You can browse through the topics again, pick what interests you, and learn more about it. And I think that will help you become a climate activist.
Great. Well, Alex, thank you so much for being on Post Carbon Radio.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
Great. Now we're actually going to take our last couple minutes and do a climate calendar. Please mark your calendar. September 29th is going to be a big date in the climate action world. There's a Women in Climate Action in New York and many others. There are many mobilizations converging on New York and also happening around the country. So whatever your climate action organization is, odds are pretty good they're going to be connected to an event on September 29th. So get that down in your calendar. And then, regardless of what you think of the UN process, there will be international mobilizations happening around the world. And those help us build movements where we are, whether or not we believe in the climate change formal process in the UN. And those start on November 29th. So September 29th is a big date, and November 29th is a big date. And then after the COP ends on December 12th, there is what's called a Paris and Beyond March. So I'm honestly not sure if that's in the Bay Area or if there are going to be multiple things around the world, but that's what I have. And Bing, I know you had another item to add to the calendar too, right?
Yeah, I just wanted to mention again that we're going to have a Fukushima report on the contamination by two top scientists. at Wednesday, September 2nd, at the Dance Palace. Dr. Timothy Mousseau, of the University of South Carolina, a biologist who's been studying the impact of radiation on bird populations, and Dr. Ken Bissler of Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute will be telling us about the ocean radiation that's coming at us and hitting the West Coast just recently.
All right, and that's it for Post Carbon Radio. You can get our podcast at
WMPostCarbon.com, and stay tuned for Cruisin' with Rick Clark.
All right.
That was a feature-length interview with myself, Alex Smith, on Post Carbon Radio on KWMR Community Radio, California. My thanks to hosts Karen Nyus and Bing Gong for this chance to review some big stories in our changing climate. Find all the past shows of Post Carbon Radio at postcarbon.podomatic.com. postcarbon.podomatic.com. It's a great show. You can find more links for the science we talked about in my own show blog, published every Wednesday at ecoshock.info. Download all our past programs for free at ecoshock.org, or look through them and listen at Radio EcoShock's SoundCloud page. We'll go out with one of my new climate songs as posted on SoundCloud. It's called Great Longing. Thank you for listening, and please join us again next week. Longing floods out from the mountains, blowing into the plains, down streets and highways, to your hiding place, to your hidden face. Nature calls out from her wounded places. Humans walk about from our walled spaces. In dancing bodies, sparks jump from mind to mind. Hearts open just enough to hear that gathering storm of change. Hearts open to welcome news and prepare for the strange. Serious people gather to talk about air. Antennae sense the waves. Weather wears farmers down. Debt is the new currency. Worry the new anthem. But nature calls out, I was always here. Return to this womb that never dies. Dine in my temple. Find your core. But you can never return to the way that was. You can never return. The prayer from those who don't believe is to go back in time, or at least to cling to what is now. Stable buildings totter. Consumption rots into rust. Oil becomes the new terrorism to the state of nature, to the mother of all. As temples of power slip beneath the rising sea, you can never return to the way that was. You can never return to the place that was. Tell me tales of refugees from the tipping time. Poles revealed to the dance of the methane sign. We would rush to the mountains, rush to the woods, rush to the source. But don't pause at that pool. Don't look at your image. It is not your face, but the outside calling, calling you to never return to the way that was.
We'll be right back.